Hello and welcome to 10 by 9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the 10 by 9 podcast. If my voice sounds a little different on this podcast than it certainly did on last week's, it's because just now I'm between homes and depending on the kindness of a very good friend, Catherine. And she's a gem, but her spare room isn't quite cut out for good sonics. But we do our best. Anyway, there are 3 wonderful stories from 3 amazing first-timers on this podcast for you.
We lay in the field canoodling. Nothing else. Canoodling. I was a good girl then, till I found out what comes after canoodling.
She'd give me head tickles, we'd play cards, or she'd bring me hot chocolate and toast. Looking back, I'd rate those tickles on a scale from 1 to 10. I realised how much care was woven into everything she did.
And she did lose all her words. But she did not stop talking. Right to the end. She would say, "Afsha." And I would join in and say, "You are joking, Mummy."
It was Wednesday, October 23rd in Belfast Black Box, and the theme was one that was very dear to my own heart. Care. We had wonderful stories with various interpretations, and it was a great night. But let's start with our first-timer. She was a whirlwind of energy. Here's Phyllis McKenna.
Okay. I was born in the 1950s, 1952 to be exact. God, I'm so old. I'm too young to appreciate the king until I turned 12. A visit to the Clonard Picture House on the Falls Road to see Blue Hawaii and my life was set. But that's another story for another time, and a good one too. When I hit 11, I was diagnosed as being short-sighted. Mr. McDonald, bottom of the White Rock, was my optician. Lovely man. He took great care of me, regular checkups, and helped me pick the right frames to suit my face. But I had to wear a pair of those awful National Health glasses, remember? Those the pink ones. Blue for boys and pink for girls. Branded for life. Specky four eyes. Judy in disguise. That was me. When I turned 13, my parents relented and bought me a pair of stylish cat's eyes, black with little diamonds on the corners. But the problem was there was no thin lenses at that time. They were like blooming milk bottles. I hadn't a hope in hell of bagging a member of the opposite sex. No boy would ever look at me or care about me. I was a specky pariah. Someone not worth lumbering, as it was called then. Do you remember lumber? Are you lumbering? I did manage to get a few boyfriends, but I think it was only because my friend Kathleen was very pretty. Long blonde hair and eyes of blue. With your long blonde hair, and I can't sing, by the way, so I'm just going to read this out. With your long blonde hair and your eyes of blue, David Boy. Even at parties, if I was invited, no one wanted to spin the bottle towards me. My self-confidence hit an all-time low, and a sort of depression set in. I mean, there were no contact lenses at that time. And no boy ever attempted to check out my personality. It was silly, really. I was the same girl with or without glasses. And truthfully, without them, I didn't look half bad. I didn't try going glassless. Don't think that's the word. I would have ended up in the Royal a lot of times a year, broken bones walking into traffic, and that's seeing the wall that was right in front of me. I have to say, though, I still don't like contact lenses. I tried them. Got one stuck in my eye, blind panic until it dropped out. Glasses for me, for sure. Anyway, they're all the rage now. Different colours, shapes and sizes. Some of them a bit out there. My daughter asked me once if I would get her glasses. 20/20 vision she had. Although she also asked me when she was about 6. Mummy, were you at the Last Supper? No, says I. Well, why didn't you go? Well, Catherine, I was washing my hair at the time. Flip, sometimes kids make you feel so flippin' old. So as I was saying, no boys cared for me or even looked my way. But then fate lent a sympathetic hand one summer weekend in 1968. See how old I friggin' am? A few of my friends now had rented a cottage in Omeath, invited a few boys down as to do. Our parents thought we were staying in each other's houses, but we all did it, didn't we? Didn't we? 16 going on 17, a fun-loving, confusing, difficult age. For the first time, I learned what it was like to have someone care for me. Didn't happen immediately when the boys arrived. I was just there for the crack and adventure. Seamus was his name. My friend Anne told me she fancied him as we were walking up the Omeath Road to the house. We had been out for coffee. You're right. We just left the pub feeling a bit jolly when Anne opened her heart. Away and walked beside him then, I advised. But it didn't turn out that way. For some unknown reason, he took to me. Wow, I was on cloud nine. Took me on his motorbike. Well, he did cause me to fall in elegantly off the back of it. We lay in the field canoodling. Nothing else, canoodling. I was a good girl then, till I found out what comes after canoodling. Oh, yeah, I'll have that, and more of that, and maybe a little bit more of that. We spent a lot of time together until my beau got a little tipsy, climbed on the roof, promptly fell off, taking half the gutter in with him. We were thrown out, told to go back to the Black North where we belonged. What was that all about? By the time the damage was discovered, the boys had gone home. Funny that, don't you think, eh? We had to borrow a tent and spend the rest of our holiday on the beach. Miserable and cramped. Cold beans, sneaking into the hotel to get washed. Freaking nightmare. I missed my beau. I meant to hang on to this one if it killed me. Then I did something stupid which could have killed me. I decided to hitchhike home alone. Stupid. But I was in love at 16 and I missed him. A lorry driver picked me up on the road, a nice man, until he turned around and asked me if I was a virgin. Well, to tell you the truth, I wasn't really sure what he meant. Birds and the Bees, my mum threw a book at me, which St. Dominic's had sent out, The Facts of Life. I was none the wiser because no explanations had come from her. So from my memory, I don't think I answered the man, I just stared at him. I have a daughter your age, he said, and kept driving. The days seemed so long before I met Seamus again. Not being a confident Matahari, I imagined his thoughts to turn to another, much prettier girl. But no, we became an item, as the Americans say. Any Americans here? And after a year or so, he sat me up in the wall on the Anderson's Town Road and said those magic words. Are you lumbering? No, I'm joking. Will you marry me? And he even asked permission to my dad. My dad was heading to bed, and a nervous lad called him back. After he stumbled through the words, my dad just said, aye, right, and proceeded to bed. Then, of course, came the ring from a wee jewellers in the town. Not a bit romantic, mind you. My new fiancé was reading a Hotspur at the counter. Well, I chose the ring. Kept reminding me to leave some money for a celebration drink. Like, really? Anyway, off we went to Glenrowan to meet my parents. Now, by this stage, I was 18. But Seamus was warned to drink no drink for me. He had to secretly throw a vodka into my pure orange. I had just gotten engaged and planned to marry, but it wasn't a little drink. We married on the 6th of February, 3 days after my birthday. 6 months later, we flew out of Belfast en route to a new life in far off Australia. Now that story is for another time.
Phyllis, thank you so much. What a joy to have you at the 10 by 9, Mike. Please come back with more of those stories you mentioned. What really happened at Blue Hawaii? Phyllis told me afterwards she had been a stand-up, and I thought, of course she had. Brilliant. As I remind you on every podcast, 10x9 is always on the lookout for storytellers, whether new or returning. And this month, we had 4 first-timers in all. So get in touch at 10x9.com. If you're a bit nervous, shy, or reluctant, remember you're the people 10x9 was created for. Okay, on to our second story, and it too came from a first-timer. He'd driven all the way from Sligo to be with us. Say hello to Jack McAteer Wallace.
Sometimes a song can pull you to a moment, like a thread connecting the past and present. For me, that song is the Black Hills of Dakota. My granny used to sing it to me as a kid, and it's ingrained in my memory. I even recorded her singing it so I could listen to it when I wanted to feel close to her. It wasn't just a song, though. It was the way she cared for me in small, quiet ways. She'd give me head tickles, we'd play cards, or she'd bring me hot chocolate and toast. Looking back, I'd rate those tickles on a scale from 1 to 10. I realised how much care was woven into everything she did. Her care, though, was reflected in who she was. Granny turned 70. She's not dead, by the way. Granny, sorry, if someone else spotted her. I'm going to lose my time here. Granny was... She's going to kill me for that. Granny turned 70 the same year I turned 21, but you'd never guess her age. With her silver grey hair, black leather skirts, and a splash of vibrant colour, she radiated life. She never left a colour without her red lipstick and rings, looking like $1 million every day, or euro, whatever, pound, since I was in Chicago for the summer. She always had a youthful energy, constant ray of sunshine. But beyond that, it was a warmth that she created. We had a sitting room, we still do, called the Red Room. The glow of the lamp, the crackle of the fire, the warmth, that room embodied home and care. My granny, a teacher who faced her own adversities, always set a time aside to care for others. She's one of the strongest people I know, and that strength has shaped my understanding of care. I remember when my young sister Mia was born, I told granny, "I'm so lucky I got to spend 8 years as your first grandchild, getting all your care. Now I get to share that with someone else." One of the hardest things about caring so deeply is doing so while navigating obsessive compulsive disorder. Whatever I cared about, whether it be family, work or life, OCD flipped it upside down. I remember it starting when I was 11 after my granddad passed away. I made a tribute video, editing videos together for the family, and they were grateful, but my head kept convincing me that I wasn't doing enough. It was hard to process, especially at that age. Years later, just before I went to college, everything felt like it was slipping through my fingers. My intrusive thoughts convinced me that I was going to fail, that I'd end up in a grave with people whispering, "Jack could have been something." I was a 6'4" growing lad on my granny's lap, just like I did as a kid, and she didn't judge me. You can find that funny if you want, mate. Granny was still there with the same care. The head tickles, hot chocolate and toast. She didn't have the social care textbooks or the answers, and neither did my mum or the rest of my family, but what they did have was compassion. 4 years later, which is the present now, I'm sitting with granny planning my graduation. She's excited. I still get hot chocolate and toast. I'm actually embarrassing it. But now I give back. She taught me that relationships aren't transactional. I think, like, where did those 4 years go? I'm graduating, and it's more about than just surviving. It's about the care that helped me get there. Care isn't always about the right words. Sometimes it's letting people go, even when you're scared for them. My family let me go off to college, even though they were afraid. That was just as much an act of love as anything. They saw the potential in me, even when I couldn't see it, just like the potential I see in the kids that I support now, even when they don't see it. At the time, I remember being terrified. I told Granny I didn't know how to be an adult. I still don't. She said, "Jack, I will always..." This is transcripted, by the way. I'm really bumping myself up here. "Jack, I will always, always love you. If I had to pick a teenager to be a beacon of light, it would be you." She's like, "You call me a ray of light, but you're one too. And when you go to college, I'll be there with the pots and pans." That stuck by me, and you care deeper when you allow yourself to be vulnerable. And I think time helps with that. As a kid, you never think your relationships will change, but they do. The version of me that sat with Granny getting tickles and hot chocolate is gone. Well, it is still there. But something actually is, last week, something else is growing. Now I give back. I brought Granny to visit a friend in Clare a few weeks ago when I thought I'd never drive. That was thanks to my Uncle Matthew sitting in front of me in the car over and over. By caring for others, I see how people cared for me. Someday, I'll care for her in her old age and nurture her in the same way she cared for me. And that's a cycle of life. It evolves, but it never disappears. Our roles may change, but the love behind it stays the same. It's not just about giving care, though. It's about learning how to receive it. Just as my granny poured me that hot cup of hot chocolate, I can't pour from an empty cup. We talk about self-care, but practice it is the hard part. It's choosing the hot chocolate instead of the wine bottle. I had that last night, that's why I'm struggling today. It's treating myself the same way my granny treated me, with patience, love and care. As I've gotten older, I've realised the depth of it. I went into social care to offer the same presence to others. Many of us enter the field because of our own struggles. My biological dad and mum split up when I was young, and I often felt like the odd one out. The kid with bleached hair, tattoos and a love for drama. That's obviously led to bullying. And while I cared deeply, I hadn't found the right people to give that care to yet. I eventually found that connection through my college friends, and I wouldn't have made it here without them. Even to the ones that I've disconnected from, I'll always cherish the care that we had during that time. My granny may not have the title of a social care practitioner, but she embodies what care is. I hope to be a fraction of that for the ones that I support. She taught me that care is woven into everyday life in the moments we often overlook, just like the hot chocolate exchange. Now, as I complete my social care degree, I see that I'm navigating things with a mosaic of everyone who shaped me. One of the kids I work with said, "You don't know what it's like to grow up in care, do you?" I was like, "No, you're right, but my family isn't traditional either. I have 3 half-siblings, 3 grannies and 3 granddads." I don't have time to explain that. Family doesn't always look like TV, and that's okay. I've learned to set my own life aside, don't focus on the care that the kids need. When I support these kids, I think about how hard it is for them to care for themselves. I've been there. I remind them that it's okay to not have all the answers. I say, I'm still figuring this out too. I don't have it all together, and that's okay. It's not about perfection, it's about connection. And as long as we're surrounded by those who care, there's always, there's light at the end of the tunnel. My mum, who still calls me morning and night, has taught me the power of unwavering support. My now dad, Kevin, stepped up to care for me and my mum and showed me what it means to show up he didn't have to. My supervisors, Kate and Geraldine, who always kept it real, and my godmother, Shell, who inspired me to go into care because of how good she is at it. Me and my brother have talked about fears of fatherhood and passing on intergenerational trauma and struggles, but I've realised I get to choose what I pass on. I can leave behind what came from the absence of love and carry forward the love that shaped me. And for a long time, I thought self-care was about things like a spa day or a latte, but there's a difference between self-indulgence and true self-care. Growing up, my family struggled to understand me, and I've struggled to understand myself. But getting an ADHD diagnosis helped me, you probably guessed that, see things through a different lens. I've learned perfection is unrealistic. Real self-care is about slowing down, watching a show without guilt, and not always feeling the need to be productive. It's about finding small ways to be kinder to ourselves. And self-care, it's not a checklist. It's different for everyone. It's about showing up even when you don't have all the answers. It's just about being there, just as my friends and family were there for me, and that's enough.
Jack, the audience loved you and your story. Well done. You were brilliant. Now, 10 by 9 is always free and always will be, as you know, but if you'd like to help ensure our events and this podcast continue to thrive, you can help us out with a donation via Patreon. There's a link on our website, that's 10by9.com. As always, a big thank you to everyone who has given, whether electronically or at our live events over the years. It really helps, and we are so grateful. I cannot stress that enough. Thank you. Okay, on to our third and final story on the theme care. It really was already such an emotional evening, and then this came along. Here's Rachel Milliken.
People will tell you terrible things sometimes. For example, if you're pregnant for the first time, people will tell you horror stories of 300 hours in labour and 200 stitches to sew your bottom back on. And they do this with dementia as well. When I began using that word about my mum in around 2016, people would tell me nightmare stories of horrible personality changes and violence. I'm sure you've heard them. And in a room this full, some of you will have had experience or be in that experience right now, that living nightmare in your families. But this is not that story. This is the story of me and my mum slowly sliding into each other's place, me becoming the caregiver and her the care receiver. We had both sold our houses in 2006 to buy one with a granny flat so that we could live together. Mum was fighting fit at that time, but Daddy wasn't, and he died in 2008. At that time, Mummy could have recited full scenes and speeches from Shakespeare, multiple stanzas from Wordsworth and Keats, various full chapters of the Bible, and also, in 2004, she had built her own computer. It was on that computer that, before any of us realised, she had researched dementia. She had made her own decisions, and she had told her doctor. She didn't want diagnosed, tested, or medicated. Now, it did become more clear to us as time went on what was happening. She would arrive home in the car missing a wing mirror very often. She'd not be able to find her morning pills, her thyroxine, her vitamins. She'd find her cornflakes in her glasses case, and then she'd eat them out of that. An English teacher by vocation, she slowly lost her ability to read, but sometimes would just read a tea cloth or a photograph. One day, in a coffee shop in Dunelm, Mummy took her seat at the table, and when I came back with her massively chocolatey cappuccino, she was crying very quietly. "What happened, Mummy? What happened?" "I'm scared." I had never known my mummy to be scared, never mind say the word. Why, Mummy, what is it? I'm scared I'll end up in a home and not be able to talk and not know anyone. Well, just don't do that then. Just stay home with me, and Joe will be there, and the girls, and David and Sarah will come. Just stay home, Mummy. I was teaching full-time A-levels, but by 2016, I'd fallen out of love with managing results data for students. I hear teachers laughing. And factory farming out assessment objective essay writers. And I didn't even recognise it as the job I'd begun in 1989. And as Mummy's needs increased and school narrowed down into an assessment culture, I decided to make a good decision. So instead of being crap at teaching and crap at looking after Mummy, I decided to resign and go home and do a better job. So that's what we did. Before we entered the care world together, we did everything that Mummy loved. Trips to the theatre in London and Belfast, silver screenings over at the Strand, coffee shops, a million coffee shops, road trips round Ireland to all the places that she'd holidayed in as a child and visited since. More coffee shops, the Big Spar, Dunelm, Tesco's. She loved that double basket trolley and just pickling about the aisles. And she'd open her purse at the till and tell them to take whatever was owed. And nobody ever cheated her. Mummy eventually forgot how to walk, which meant that a full care package kicked in. A wheelchair arrived. Social workers, community nurses, the hoist. The direct payment scheme came at a good time. And then a hospital bed. And she did lose all her words. But she did not stop talking, right to the end. She would say, "Afsha, afsha, 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 afsha." And I would join in and say, "You are joking, Mummy." In the last weeks, in her bedroom, we watched old family videos together. And I read to her from scrapbooks that she had made, recounting the wonder years at Queen's Dramatic Society, the group theatre, Sam Thompson's Over the Bridge, Portrush Summer Theatre, amateur dramatic festival wins for Dad as the best actor and Mum as the best producer, all over Ireland. School play productions in Regent House, the Academy, Ballyclare High, newspaper cuttings, reviews, congratulation cards, telegrams. I sang to her an old song that she would have known from the Church of Ireland. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got you and me, Mummy, in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. Mummy died at home, in her sleep, on the 11th of March 2020, just before the world locked down. We did a COVID funeral at home, 10 people, 2 on Zoom. We did lockdown grieving. Later, people would ask me, "Well, how did you do that? What was your approach? Did her personality change? Was she aggressive? Was it a nightmare?" Well, her personality did change, but only into who I imagined she must have been as a child. She became more tactile and soft. She laughed a lot at her own funniness. "How much did you get for that room of flies?" Do not misunderstand, though. She struggled and she suffered. There were great, great losses. But tonight, let this story stand as her voice to say, don't be frightened. Don't be frightened. I've never known anyone do dementia like her. I'm so proud of her. Our mum, Lucy.
Rachel, what a gorgeous tribute to Lucy and what an amazing woman she was. Thanks for your story, but thank you for letting us know Lucy was here and was brilliant. So good. And that's it for this podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website at standby9.com, and I'll be putting up the dates for 2025 very soon. Now, while 10x9 is always free, some events might require tickets from the venues, so keep an eye out for that. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and our Instagram, and I promise not to flood your feed with nonsense, just information. Thanks to everyone who helps make 10x9 happen. Leanne and Margaret have been supporting us for years, and they're a joy. Plus, on this evening, DJ Cara was in the sound box. The Black Box is, of course, the best venue anywhere. Thanks to Darren and the team for being so brilliant. And what a wonderful, responsive audience as ever. It's always a joy to experience how supportive they are to the storytellers and to me with my awful dad jokes. A massive thank you, as always, to all our storytellers, of course. All so good, but especially Phyllis McKenna, Jack McAteer Wallace, and Rachel Milliken. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.